Here we are, ready to finish everything off that we, so we'll have no more questions. So as usual, I'm behind, and my apologies for that. And although I did not do this yesterday, as we have done on other days, I'd like us to start this morning with what you've been thinking about, either between last night or tonight, but today most especially. So what are the questions, statements that you need to say before this class ends? So let's just let, good? Yeah, just let me just say one more word about this. So I'm gonna see if we can, I have of course my list that will take an hour and a half, but I'm going to add this at the beginning, and we'll probably just dive in to what you're thinking. And so I will take the whole list first, because there may be some things that can be dovetailed together.
I'm really interested in knowing as to how much resistance there is to this kind of thinking. Uh-huh. And I mean, I picture going back to my Wednesday text study, and there's already somebody who's done a whole lot of reading on this, particularly wisdom. And but I picture how I might bring some of this in, particularly if we're looking at Luke. And where does the resistance come? I mean, other than fundamentalists who see that this is messing with what God said.
So, just a research, is by resistance to this, do you mean what one might call analytic studies of the Bible, or do you mean mostly the new discoveries?
The new discoveries.
Okay. All right. Great. Other. And I'll write these down as statements or questions. Yes, Jim.
How this relates to Gnostic writings, which is a phrase I kind of just remember from seminary.
Yeah, thank you. You promised to ask that, because I had not dealt with it this week.
I just have a statement. It struck me yesterday as really amazing that when you were talking about in the 1980s how people... there was sort of this feminist reading into Luke, and I was like, we've had the Bible for like 2,000 years, and we're still able to find really meaningful, meaty research where people can write papers on it, and like, I just think it's really amazing that the Bible is so, like Jim said, it's living, it's living word, and
thank you. I'm writing this down, and I probably will make a little statement about what you just said, which is quite wonderful.
Al, I was going to say, you had mentioned at one point getting together Buddhists and Christians to just read Thomas, and if you ever do that, I want to be a fly on the wall.
About the makeup of the group that studied these findings.
Is that the New Orleans group?
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Was wisdom literature a dominant genre in that time, or was it something kind of the side of culture or center to culture? How
do
we understand it?
Oh, can hardly wait to talk about that. Okay, good. Let me tell you my agenda. The two things that I promised to do before today and haven't done is talk about, we talked at length yesterday about gender in Luke, And I forgot that right below that was the question about gender in Thomas. And so, and this is quite, it's important to say that by gender I mean, what does it mean to be men, women, and others according to the Gospel of Thomas? And that's what we were doing yesterday with, a little bit with Luke. So I'm going to catch up on that. I also had for yesterday and didn't do, trying to put together the picture of Jesus in Thomas, the picture of Jesus in Luke, and how they overlap and differ. So to kind of put the Jesus pictures together, because we've been so focused on specific texts, we haven't had a chance really to say, okay, step back and look at who, we even alluded to doing this yesterday, what's a whole picture of the Luke and Jesus, for instance. Okay. And then finally, on your handout, if we may get to that today, but this is last on my list, is our what I call medium-sized and big questions about Luke and Thomas. Notice that sometimes in this week together, we've been really boring in on very specific things, and sometimes we've gotten really wonderfully large questions, but we've never given ourselves a chance to ask mostly what I call medium-sized to large questions. So I would aim to do some final thinking together about that. Well, let's start with what we brought together this morning. How much resistance is there to this? The documents that have been discovered, and I usually count this back to about 1850. Just a little bit of a word about why this happened. It's really interesting, comical, and curious. So why we discovered more than or around 150 new documents since 1850, more than we had discovered in the previous 1,000 years, and it actually turns out to be make sense and be weird. So 1850 is not an incidental time to ask this about. From then on, because in the mid 19th century, Europeans had at their access a lot of transportation modes. So by the mid 19th century, the rich Europeans were going on long vacations to the Mediterranean. Northern Africa, the middle, so-called Middle East, Greek. So there's this lots of tourism, mostly rich people, into that area. And among them, interestingly enough, was a decent group of rich Bible scholars. And so they weren't going for anything. They were just taking vacation. But what happened is that, especially in North Africa, and I'll get to that in a minute, especially in North Africa, there would be, let's say, a Bible scholar from Germany, along with his family, wandering through the Cairo marketplace. And there, in the marketplace, would be somebody selling ancient manuscripts. Basically, Egyptians know that they are important because their culture is going back to before 3000 BCE. And so the marketplace in Cairo has really been famous for a long time about ancient manuscripts. And so all of a sudden, these European scholars who happened to be there would be walking through and they would say, wait a minute. And they'd look at it and they would say, I can't believe that I'm in a marketplace and here is a document either that I know about or that I've never heard of, and they would buy it. This happened for quite a while until the universities themselves started sending scholars, still in the 19th century, for a paid vacation down there to study things and find stuff. And so this was why people began finding documents. Here's the real other funny, quirky thing, is that, for instance, the Gospel of Mary was found in exactly this way. A strolling German scholar in the Cairo market looks down, and there, in Coptic, is the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. He bought it, took it home. Why that happened is that if you had a copy of the Gospel of Mary, let's say in Greece, Israel, or Italy, it wouldn't exist because it's too wet. So it turns out that papyrus can last thousands of years in North Africa and only would have a life of about 200 years in the rest of the European area. So pretty quickly, Europeans and then American scholars got the message, got the memo, and started doing major archaeological digs in North Africa, and finding mainly much of what they were aiming for was just documents. So for instance, in the 1890s, Oxford and Cambridge sent a whole bunch of researchers down for 10 years because they knew they had discovered the existence of a first and second century city in central Egypt. They went there, and the problem was that there was a regular 19th century city on top of it. So I'm surprised that European colonists had this thought. They said, let's not destroy the city. But what they did do is they found on the outskirts the trash dump of the ancient city. They spent 10 years digging up the trash from the first and second centuries. And they packed them all up and sent them back to Egypt. They formed a group of 10 researchers to begin looking at what they had in all their big things that they sent home, big suitcases and everything. And so they began working, these 10 people. Not those 10 people, but that department is still opening boxes from 1890, and they're 15% through what they brought back, and they've already found two new gospels. Parts of them. You know, it was a trash dump. But so just to see what happened, kind of weirdly and accidentally, of why we got all these new things. It was nobody's plan. There wasn't a plot for, I hope we can find something like this. It was just, can you believe all of this stuff that we don't know and we'd like to bring it back? And in the meantime, by the way, most of those pieces that were found have been returned to museums in Egypt because the UN intervened and said, you can't take a people's treasures. So anyway, I just had to give you a context for all of this. Because so then the question, I think the first question I want to say is, how much resistance has there been to all of the things discovered rather than just my work? And the answer is lots. There's been lots of interest in it, but the larger scholarly community very quickly went to saying this must all be heretical. Or if it's not heretical, it's just bad. And so for really the first 40 or 50 years, and we'll get back to this a little bit, scholars started calling almost all discovered documents Gnostic and saying that that was a heresy. We'll get back to that in a minute, that other scholar, other term of Gnosticism. But so what I want you to know is that basically scholars from the very beginning were downplaying this material. And it was only in the second half of the 20th century that major departments in universities across Europe and America started saying, we think we jumped the gun on the character of this material, and we need to do a second and third look at it. When that happened, the public started getting aware of it. So, for instance, the New York Times would regularly give a report if something was discovered. And so this is where I was telling you early in the week, when that started happening and I was on the road giving talks in the 1980s and 1990s, I, who had been educated by my teachers that this wasn't important, I would pass on the word that they didn't need to bother about what was in the New York Times. So I was part of the resistance to this material for a long time. And it was only my students and public people who said, I like this stuff, could you please take another look at it? Mm-hmm. But that was just my story. So then, I then got a whole bunch at Union Theological Seminary, a whole bunch of people who wanted to do PhDs in this material and to study with me. Because in the meantime, I had learned Coptic because I was trying to do a better job with this. So that led to a lot of public interest by my students, and so they it became clear from their reports and my experiences that people kept saying in the public spheres, couldn't we please see this laid alongside the canon? And so then I went to an agent, and they found a publisher, a big publisher, in which the Houghton Mifflin Harcourt said, please add as many as you can or want to of the new documents to a New Testament. Not the New Testament, but how would it look if there were more? And we then had 19 spiritual leaders in the country join me for a year in studying 75 of those new discoveries. And I asked Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, how many can we add? And they said, as many as are good. The spiritual leaders that Houghton Mifflin Harcourt paid to come and decide which are good, which were across all denominations, they said, what are your criteria? And I said, the criteria are yours. You are known in the public for giving good reads to people who want to read more. So you just decide what will help people most, mainly in their spiritual and intellectual interests. So for your interest in my book, has had minimal resistance. My publisher criticized me because I wasn't generating enough controversy. I don't think that that's a particular full read, because one of the things we've seen, and this is not in relationship to my work, but the larger interest across the scholarly now it is true that a number of evangelical universities have launched programs in this material in order to show that it is not as good as the New Testament. So now there is an organized attempt in scholarship to challenge what they call liberal scholarship that's doing that. And I frankly welcome more study of all kinds, because I think evangelicalism has a good record in some cases of studying the ancient world. So that's kind of an overview.
Wonderful, thank you.
Okay. How about Gnosticism? Jim asked. So again, here there has been lots of scholarship about Gnosticism and calling many of these a part of a Christian heresy called Gnosticism. And so what has happened in the last 30 years, well, 40 years. So Elaine Pagel's, although most scholarship has said in its first two generations, this material is heretical and is a part of the heresy of Gnosticism. That's shifted now. And Elaine Pagels, many of you have probably read her very important book, The Gnostic Gospels, which is still the 17th highest book on ancient Christianity selling, even though it was published in 1979. She gave an overview for the public of about 18 of those discoveries. And she called them Gnostic herself. In her portrayal of it, and she and I have worked together on PhD students and the like, first of all, she made the public aware of all of this. And she called it Gnostic, although she didn't talk much about what Gnosticism was in the book itself. What she did say is how wonderful the new discoveries were compared to the canon. So if you read her closely, she doesn't say this too out loud, but I think she suggests that the newly discovered material is better than the canon. I think she calls it more sophisticated. I disagree with that. And in the middle of all of that discussion, and we owe Elaine Pagels everything, that she, as a very young scholar, she got the public aware of these discoveries. In the meantime, Karen King at Harvard was also studying this, and Karen, after about 10 years in her career, she said, I think there is no such thing as Gnosticism, historically. One of the first things she pointed out is the word Gnosticism doesn't even exist in the ancient world. So, in other words, nobody ever calls anything Gnosticism in the ancient world. The word Gnostic is used, and the word Gnostic simply means somebody who knows stuff. It comes from the Greek word gnosis, which is just knowledge. So a Gnostic is a knowledgeable person. By and large, when you see the way the Greek word Gnostic is used, it's mostly used positively, not to indicate discovered documents or documents outside the New Testament, but that's a smart person. So the word Gnostic can be used for a bricklayer, can be used for a teacher, can be used for a healer, because it's somebody who knows something. Occasionally, you'll see the word Gnostic used to say a know-it-all, not just someone who's knowledgeable, but someone who's pretending to know more than they know. So that is a secondary use of the word Gnostic. So in the 19th and 20th century, when people started saying, we think that there is a Christian heresy built on know-it-alls, built on people who teach you secret sayings. And you'll see that, for instance, in the Gospel of Thomas, it is called a secret saying. And that is a reason to be suspicious of making Christianity into a secret religion. What Karen King points out, however, is that, for instance, the Gospel of Mark teaches that it shows its portrayal of Jesus is Jesus is trying to teach a secret message to his followers. So, for instance, in chapter 4 of the Gospel of Mark, Jesus takes his disciples aside and says, you know why I'm telling parables? To confuse the public. And I'm taking you aside so that only you will know. When Peter says to Jesus, you are the Son of God, Jesus says back, don't tell anyone. So, if you want to say that there is a heresy that is promoting Christianity as secret knowledge, you have to include the first canonical gospel. And of course, Matthew and Luke often repeat what Mark does, but not so intentionally. So I would say about a third of New Testament scholarship now agrees with Karen King, including Elaine Pagels. She's changed her mind. They're good friends. And about a third of scholarship now says there is no such thing as Gnosticism. That doesn't mean that early Christ people of the second century weren't fighting with each other, saying, we're right and you're wrong. By and large, it seems unhelpful to think of every new discovered document as a part of a Gnosticism heresy. So that's where I am, Jim, and that's, I would say, about a third of my colleagues have read Karen King and agree with it, and some have read it and don't agree with it, and a lot of them haven't read it. Would you have any follow-up?
No. I mean, that rings true. And part of me wondered why that's if you hadn't mentioned it. I think it's one of those things, as soon as you say it's Gnostic, it's like, oh, well, then you just put it aside, because right. We all know that
right. It's bad.
Gnosticism is heresy. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would say when the Gospel of Thomas was first, the first generation of the Gospel of Thomas, everybody said it was Gnostic.
See, I mean, having read Thomas, I didn't get that sense.
Right.
Now, the Gospel of Mary,
mm-hmm. you might say,
lends more, mm-hmm. as I read it, it's like, oh, the idea that Jesus told her
and
secret things.
Else, yeah.
And then you read those secret things and they make little to no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, we could talk about that. I did that last year, though, in that course.
I think this is a wonderful discussion. My experience in the Catholic Church is the same as you said. Gnosticism was this kind of woo-woo, kind of thing that you couldn't trust, and because it wasn't conceptual and intellectual and formed in these intellectual dogmas. But the thing that's interesting about your conversation on wisdom is how you move from dogma toward experience, and how important stories are sometimes to get a much closer to the experience of the living God than a dogma would. And so I'm thinking that in the fear of Gnosticism must have been the fear of what we learn from experience, which to me is more important than what I learned from dogma. And this has a huge bearing on your discussion of wisdom literature. Am I getting this?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Next thought was, isn't it amazing that the Bible is still living and people are still working on trying to understand it? And I have to say, I really love my job. and it's true that the intersection of how, you know, this kind of setting happens so much at the drop of a hat because people really want to know what all of this is, what is going on. And I think it's true also, if it was all bad literature, people would learn that pretty quickly. So it's a living document. Buddhist and Christian, we talked about that earlier. It does look like the Gospel of Thomas sounds like teaching of the Buddha to a lot of Americans. And what I said on Tuesday is this: we have to have Buddhist and Thomas scholars get together for 10 years to test this out. So for instance, what I didn't say is, I do know a couple of such conversations that have happened, and so far they're not going like we thought it should. So for instance, one of the things that some conversations between Buddhist scholars and Thomas scholars have shown in just initial conversations is that the parts of Buddhist teachings that sound the most like the Gospel of Thomas are much older or younger than the period of the Gospel of Thomas. Because, you know, Buddhism has a really long history. And the first disappointing thing for those, and I frankly don't have a dog in the race, or a horse in the race. I don't care how that comes out. I just think we should figure it out. And so it was disappointing for the hoping to make a connection there in the first time, because it seemed like what Buddhist teachers were writing in the time of Thomas was quite different than Thomas. You notice that that doesn't answer all the questions, right? Because if older of them sounded like Thomas, there's every reason to think that they were passed down. So, I don't think there's any way around somebody funding a 10-year study by not one scholar or three scholars, but a group of scholars to try to figure this out. I have at Union Theological Seminary, about 15% of our student body at a Christian seminary were people who had dropped out of Christianity, gone to Buddhism, got renewed in that, and decided that, like Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, that if they are American, they might try Christianity again with their Buddhist experience. So we had one of the major kinds of students we had were people who had felt like they had been saved from hating Christianity by Buddhist practice. And then when they read Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, who always say, listen, if you were born in this religion, you might want to try it again. and we Buddhists would be happy to contribute whatever we can. So a lot of those students then, for instance, are still Buddhists in practice. They meditate a lot, and they're really interested in trying to become Christians again. Some words about the group that studied. I'm going to say just a word about the group that studies these documents overall, the new documents, and that is some of them do it out of religious experience and interest. Some of them do it out of historical interest. I am not seeing religious tendencies in the big picture of folks that study that. It seems like everything from really intense Christians to sort of moderate Christians to anti-Christians are reading this. And they seem to be doing a fairly good job. In other words, the big question in the scholarship is not, how can this fit with my Christianity? But can we just please get a notion of what it all means? But then for a New Testament, so what I did to get the people who in the end decided to add 10 documents to a New Testament, there we had all major denominations, including Catholic, the one Catholic bishop who had agreed to come got sick, but we had two very leading women people from the Vatican who were a part of it, and then we had bishops from most of the denominations. We had John Dominic Crossan and Karen King as scholars, we had two nationally known rabbis and one Hindu scholar.
Is this the New Orleans group?
Yeah, it's the New Orleans group. We called it the New Orleans Council. The person who asked that, do we need to ask some other questions? Yes.
No, I think that was very well done.
Okay, thanks. The last question I have here from you all is, how important was the wisdom genre, the wisdom kind of teaching in the first and second century? Was that the... pretty important, I think, is the answer. Not the most important. I can just say briefly what happened there. So wisdom literature is an ancient Israelite way of thinking. It's not the only way of thinking in Israel, but of course, at least six documents of the Old Testament is wisdom. The biggest probably of which is the Book of Proverbs. But what happened also is as Israel was overwhelmed by first the Greeks, and Alexander the Great conquered all of Israel and instituted a lot of Greek thinking. Then the Romans did the same thing. That brought lots of wisdom thinking from Greece and other Eastern countries into the first century. So that actually, the people of Israel experienced that as very helpful to mix their wisdom with wisdom from Egypt and Greece and the Near East. What they liked about it is, you know, when they, for 400 years, had to live under the thumb of these and well, more than 400 years, of these other countries. What one of some of the questions were, what is it like to experience the world with it changing? And so the wisdom methodology of stay with your experience and just listen to what comes from your inside and outside about what things mean is helpful. So I would say it seems fairly clear that Jesus himself was a wisdom sage. And that, as we said, probably didn't know how to read or write. He only reads in Luke of the four canonical gospels. But he was a peasant sage. And he taught in the marketplace and in the meals that he could get into. But on the other hand, this time is also a time of the great stories. And wisdom teachers aren't very interested in big stories. They're more interested in little sayings. So that's why we have the Gospels that are in the canon trying to put together a great story of Jesus, a big story, not just one little parable. And so you see that, and then you see everybody there also taking in some of the wisdom teachings and showing Jesus as a teacher, as well as a healer, a martyr, and a divine figure. So I want to say, yes, it's important. It's not the only thing playing. Okay, did this generate some other thoughts that people want to jump in with? Yes?
I'm intrigued by the fact of the history of how people in the Greek world in Africa actually attempted to destroy libraries or move libraries. And my example would be that I learned recently that Cleopatra, when she was involved in the great conflict with the Romans and the Greeks, came into Ephesus, that famous city of the New Testament, and in fact moved the whole library to Alexandria.
Yep.
And then most recently, in Timbuktu, mm-hmm. which is in Africa, mm-hmm. the Muslims have tried to destroy every book in that ancient library mm-hmm. that must include a lot of these same kind of documents you're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Glaive.
So, from my understanding, the Hadith in Islam tradition included, was a collection of sayings of Muhammad, but also rapidly expanded, and there was a billion beats, and they included sayings from people all over the world. Mm-hmm. Has there been a comparative study between what happened with that and the latter gospels,
I mean, the studies like that began mainly with the very early 19th century studies of the canonical gospels. And I think I can say clearly that both the books inside the New Testament and outside the New Testament have clear vestiges and quotes from those other settings. Yeah, especially
what he said. What were those other settings? I didn't hear.
Just the way Muslim wisdom has developed. They've borrowed from all of them. Okay, so let me do some more. I'm going to do gender in the Gospel of Thomas in 3.5 minutes. What I put up here are the sayings in Thomas that are about gender. But I'm going to summarize this. So one of the main things that Jesus says in Thomas about being men and women is they are, that God made them one at the beginning, and Jesus and wisdom make them one as much as possible. So literally you will find sayings in the Gospel of Thomas where Jesus says, men and women are or should become one gender, one being. So Jesus here thinks that women and men were one being in the beginning, and that God now asks them to become one being now. So this is the, remember we saw around the edges earlier in the week, we saw how Jesus keeps saying, I am undivided, you should be undivided, we all should be undivided. Well, 22 says, and I will make male and female one. Celibacy is the wrong way to think about Thomas. I think it's a word that Protestants and Catholics both have made into caricatures. It's quite clear, and we talked about this a bit last night in the sexuality course, it's quite clear that Thomas thinks that people shouldn't be married. And Thomas urges, I mean, not Thomas, Jesus and Thomas, and these are almost the same exact sayings that we find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in which he said, who are my brothers and sisters? Who's my mother? It's the person who listens to God, not the one that I'm related to in blood. Thomas, I think, is a little stronger on that point than Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but mostly shared. So this is, and then in addition, Jesus and Thomas says in a number of places, you should be alone. You should live alone. So what we think is this is what one might call asceticism, in which people leave their family and live in either small groups or alone. The reason to do that socially is that the family in that time, and maybe in other times, is violent. And so it's really a violent experience for most women in that day to be in families. It's intensely patriarchal. In fact, we see in the Bible where women are treated as where wives are treated as property. So there is that kind of quote celibacy. That is, there's a, I think Jesus and Thomas encourages people to leave marriage or not get married and to be basically sages on their own. Probably, they probably talk to each other. there are a couple of places in Thomas where Jesus says women are dangerous. You need to know that the same kind of unfortunate teachings we find in the New Testament are also a little bit in Thomas too. Then there is the very infamous saying number 114. Okay, I heard somebody groaning. Because this is the last saying in Thomas, and because it's very controversial, we'll say a little bit about this. Simon Peter said to them, let Mary leave us, for women do not deserve life. Say that again. Peter says, get Mary out of our group because women shouldn't be living. Jesus takes up the fence, sort of. Jesus says, look, I will lead her so that I make her male, which will make her into a living spirit resembling you males. For any woman that makes herself male will enter the realm of heaven. So just a little bit of context here. So, and I alluded to this last night in the other course. So by and large, I think one would have to say that the ancient Mediterranean world only thinks there is one gender, and that is masculine. That women themselves are not quite human. And that they simply don't have the material to be a full human. So you see this in here. So in other words, Jesus' only move in Thomas towards participation by women, and it is for he to make them men, and then the second move is for they to make themselves men. Now that is clearly, in other literature, that's clearly done. That is, women cut their hair, dress like men in public so they themselves can be teachers about Jesus. So that's, in other words, that's probably in their heads too. I'm called to teach about Jesus, and I know that Jesus wants that, and I'm going to make myself a male. That doesn't really match up with the way we think of gender today. And it seems to me like this just has to be said. This is a really stinky saying by Thomas.
Also, it's not the way we think about gender today here. Right? I mean, there's still plenty of places in the world where women would not be allowed to teach in a religious setting for the very fact of gender.
Yeah, and it, and by and large, women are women that make themselves into men and teach in the first century are a relative exceptions. Mm-hmm. There are some other philosophers, women philosophers, that do the same.
I would add that it's not that ancient a construct here either. when you look up when women got to vote.
Yeah. Great point, Jim.
I was just thinking you could also, it'd be interesting to put this into the context of a story where, you know, so you picture one of the times that Peter says something ridiculously stupid, like he often does.
Right, yeah.
And then have Jesus turn to him and say, yeah, when women become as smart as you, Peter, then they'll be fully human too. I mean, you can almost make him sneer at this as if he's mocking the males about how smart they are.
Nice try.
Well, I was just so into a living spirit.
Yeah.
Is that teacher or is that?
That I think just means human being.
Something other.
I think that means a real human.
Okay, so make her male, which will make her into a living spirit. So. Yeah. So fully human, so she's not really fully human yet.
Right, yes, exactly. No, yeah, right. No, I don't.
And are all males living spirits in this
yes.
world?
Yes.
Okay.
In the world. I mean, in the Mediterranean world. That's the way they think.
Do you have a guess about what Mary is referring to?
I think the guess is usually Magdalene.
Okay.
So in the last 4 years, the Catholic Church has had two synods, one on the family and one on children, and there wasn't a single woman voting voice in either of those synods.
So I remember reading a number of years ago that just the word woman, it kind of means less than man originally. And so in a way, you can think of this as, you almost translate this into different in different words, you can say Mary is less than human, and I'm going to make her human.
Right.
It's not that he's going to change her biology or change her genitalia or something like that.
Right.
He's just going to raise her up to be on the same level as the rest of us, and that seems a little bit less.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it is still very much in keeping with it is a male world, and therefore a woman to
to have equal status, they have to basically be like a man. Yeah. And I remember that still being, I remember people referring to Margaret Thatcher as essentially a male politician.
Yeah.
Because in order, she had to be so strong and everything in order to be respected, and people saw, okay, well, that means she's basically a man.
Yeah.
So in this line of thought around women not being fully human, et cetera, what's the real danger that they represent? Is it to emasculate the male? Is it to somehow?
If this, and again, this is, so this is a big question about the emergence of patriarchy, right? Which does this around the world in different ways. This is the Mediterranean version. I think a major part of figuring out patriarchy is male fear, but also male power, but those kind of go together. Fearful, powerful people are more dangerous and more violent. There are lots of really good books on how patriarchy happened, but it happened for a long time, and one can say it's still happening. Did you want to say something?
I just wonder if there's this sense, though, of regard the woman as dangerous. She must hold power.
Yeah. But that's what I meant to say is masculine fear.
Yeah.
And that's fear of women, in great part.
Yeah. Well, that made me think of, so wisdom is often viewed as a woman, but usually there's two kind of wisdom women. There's the one that leads you to the right path,
right.
But there's also the wisdom woman who leads you to the wrong path.
That's right in the middle of Proverbs.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a dangerous woman who, you know, takes young men off the path they're supposed to go to.
So you'll forgive me if I say that I'm going to talk for another 4 minutes against my time craziness of stopping on time, just because I don't want our last topic to be about 1:14. But so what I'm going to do just briefly is I want to just talk a little bit about who Jesus is in both of these Gospels. So I want to say for both of them, Jesus is divine. This is counter to liberal tendencies of the 1970s to 1990s, in which they said Jesus is only human in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I think that in both Thomas and in Luke, Jesus is a kind of divine figure. But the really important thing to suggest is that in this period, both in Israel and in the Mediterranean overall, there are gods and goddesses. There are divine figures that aren't the big G. They're the medium-sized G. So let me give the examples from the Bible. The Son of Man is a divine figure that God sends from heaven and goes back to heaven in Daniel. So that's the... similarly, the figure of wisdom is a divine figure in Proverbs. Clearly divine. She descends to upbraid and inspire people and goes back up to God. These are medium-sized gods. A whole bunch of spirit people in this period, both inside and outside the Christ movements, they are some sort of divine character. The really interesting thing about Luke is Luke will say about him being Messiah, Son of God, and Son of Man, never talks in the I. This is really interesting. Jesus talks in the third person when he talks, when he's talking about him, he said, himself, for instance, he says, the Son of Man will be crucified and rise again. He doesn't say, I will be crucified and rise again. There's no place in Luke or Mark or Matthew where Jesus says, I am the Son of God, I am the Son of Man, I am the Messiah. He does say that I am in John, where he says, I am also bread and everything else. But so Jesus is more divine in John than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Thomas. So, in other words, it's really interesting. I think we correctly, when Jesus says the Son of Man is going to be killed and raised again, that he's talking about himself. But why doesn't he say I? And I think the answer is, it is doing reverence to the infiniteness of big G and saying, I'm a smaller G. So that's, I want to say it's very clear, although there are different kinds of medium G's in Luke and Thomas, both are divine. But neither of them are the big G. I'm not saying that Jesus doesn't eventually become a big G Trinitarianly for Christians, but these folks aren't Christian yet, right?
Yeah.
They say themselves, they don't know about Christian. Then other things. So in Luke, Jesus is a healer. In Thomas, Jesus is not. In Thomas, Jesus is more like the figure of wisdom herself. But in Luke, Jesus specifically says he is wisdom herself. Thomas, Jesus lives forever, but doesn't die and is not raised. In Luke, Jesus dies, really dies, and really is risen. In Luke, Jesus is, as a baby, proclaimed a Messiah, Lord, and Son of God. So, in other words, Jesus never says that, but angels say that in Luke. That's, again, a really, I think, subtle honoring of the big G and a proclamation of the grandness of Jesus' medium-sized G. All right. That was 6 minutes, and from my point of view, little Jesuses that I just gave you. I apologize. Thanks a lot.